I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Ronnie F. from San Jacinto.
They're already telling me when to stop. I'm an alcoholic, Ronnie Fox. I'm sober by the grace of God in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad to be here tonight. My sobriety date is February 27th, 91, and for that I'm very grateful. Thank my wife for coming with me. I get nervous sometimes before I do this, and she always says, "You'll be all right, you'll be all right." And, you know, I don't believe her very often, but with, but when she tells me that, I try to buy into it, you know. I got a friend here that I wanted to mention. His name is Greg. And Greg rode his bike from 70th up the hill to get here tonight. You know, and that's what I call willing to go to any length. So, all right on, Greg. Okay. I'm originally from Los Angeles. I was born there. Lived there for most of my life. I grew up in a home with a very loving mother. She did everything that a loving mother would do for her son. You know, I mean, she really, really was a very loving mother, and I can't imagine anybody ever having a mother as good as I had. You know, and. I was about, 5 or 6, and I had a sister, and we were over at the next door neighbor's house or something, and I don't know how the conversation came up, but my sister had mentioned the fact that my mother had been raped, and I was the product of that rape, and I didn't know at that age what all that meant. But I knew from that point on there was something wrong with me. I knew that something was wrong, you know. And my mother was white. My sister's white. I'm not, obviously. And, and growing up in Los Angeles 70 years ago or 65 years ago, you know, there was a lot of prejudice. And I've got these issues going on now that my mom's white, and I'm trying to fit in. Where do I fit in, you know? And now I've got this thing that there's something wrong with me, that maybe I did something. Maybe I'm responsible for something. It was very, very, very difficult. And then later on, before too long, I realized that my mom was gay. So I got a lot of stuff going on for a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, and I don't know really what's going on. I don't know where my place in this whole family or this world is, and I'm pretty confused. And you know what? I was about as normal as I could be. I mean, I was. I liked all the stuff that a 10-year-old would like, you know. And my mom started me fishing when I was really young, and you know that's my great love right now. That's my big hobby. And that was the thing that I enjoyed doing. And I'm about 12 or 13 now. This guy that was living next to me, his family was having a party. So I was over there, and we stole a couple cans of beer out of this big bucket with ice in it. And I had never drank anything, and I drank that. And you know what? My life has never been the same, you know? It was just something about that I knew. It's like when my mother took me fishing the first time, and I come up over this hill and I saw the ocean. I knew the ocean was going to be something in my life forever. And when I hit that beer, I knew that beer was going to be something. That alcohol was going to be in my life. And, I didn't get drunk. I didn't go out and, you know, do no crazy stuff. But I knew that there was something about that. And you know, and... I was hanging out with some guys that were a little older than me, and you know, we were drinking Thunder Chicken, you know, and Silver Satin and Ripple, and you know, and we were getting it on, you know, and we'd drink that stuff and we'd sing and we were going to parties, and you know, and we go to parties and to have a good time, but we actually ended up going to parties to throw up, you know. I did. You know, I was a serial puker. I mean, you know, I got to where I could walk down the street and go, and never miss a beat, you know. And, well, you got to be able to do that if you're cool, you know. And that's all, really all I ever wanted to be was just cool, you know. So, you know, I'm growing up, I'm drinking, and I got married really young. I got married at 18, and the woman I married was 18, and you know, I had learned a trade. You know, I was going into a shoe shop after school and hanging out with that dude, and I had kind of picked that trade up, and I had went to work for his uncle, and I had a pretty, you know, it was a pretty good job. I was making $60 a week. You know, I mean, that seems like just nothing, but, you know, I don't know how he did it, but I was paying the rent and buying the groceries and all the other stuff with $60 a week, you know. And so I got married, and you know what? I was still drinking, but I wasn't, I mean, it wasn't out of control, you know. It says in the book that we crossed that imaginary line. I had not crossed that imaginary line. I didn't even know where it was yet. But I knew that there's something was going on here because I liked the effects of alcohol. And so we get married, you know, I'm on my own now. I mean, I've got a wife. I got my own place. I can do what I want to do, you know. And what I want to do is maybe drink a little more than I had been drinking before. And we had a baby. We had a baby girl. And you know, I didn't know. I didn't know how to be a husband. I mean, I had never even seen those dynamics working. I mean, I grew up in a home that was, there was no man, you know, there was no man. My mom, like I say, was gay, and I had no real male in my life to tell me the stuff that I needed to know, you know. And so naturally, I learned that shit from my boys on the street, you know, and that may not have been the best place, you know. I don't know where they got this information. So, you know, I'm married. I got a baby. I don't know how to be a husband. I don't have no idea. And now I got a baby, and I got no idea how to be a father. You know, so I figured the next best thing to do is be buy a business that I don't know how to run. I mean, I knew how to do the work. But I did. I quit school in the 10th grade, and I had no business experience. So you know, I buy a business, and now I don't know how to run this business, and I'm running amok. You know, I'm ordering equipment, and I'm ordering material, and I'm not paying for it, you know, and I'm scared because I don't know quite what I'm doing, but I can't cop to being scared, you know, because I'm still cool. So I'm drinking a little bit. I got this business now that I'm there all day by myself. I don't really have anybody to answer to, but I can drink more. You know, and the worst thing an alcoholic can do is hang out with another alcoholic, somebody a little bit more advanced in it. And my advanced friend's name was Jim. And me and Jim would go out at night and ride around in his car, and we'd drink Clooney scotch and chase women. And I'm married, okay? And now I'm drinking a lot. You know, I'm drinking a lot. And I got this wife that's wanting to know why I'm out all night. And I got a baby that I don't know how to be a father. And I got this business that I'm really not doing a very good job. And it kind of got to me, and I didn't know what to do. So one day I went to work, and I just didn't come home. And I took off, and I moved. Oh, I didn't move. I ran away. Shit. I ran away to San Francisco. I jumped on a Greyhound bus and went to San Francisco, and left that wife and left that baby. and left that business, you know. And the only thing that made it okay was the fact that I had a pint of Jim Beam on the bus as I left, you know. And I got to San Francisco and went on to Oregon and now I'm trying to live with the fact that I've done all this crap. You know, I've got that wife and I got that baby back there in Los Angeles, and I feel like crap. And this wonderful life that I experienced, that I thought was going to happen when I ran away, didn't happen. You know, and I'm feeling like crap. And the only relief I could get would be to drink. And I'm drinking a lot. And I ended up coming back to L.A. and trying to get back with that wife. And, you know, she had probably, and still has, the two most wonderful parents anybody I've ever met in my life. You know, they took me in. They treated me. They could have treated me pretty rotten because the things that I had done, you know, but they didn't. They took me in, and they treated me like I was their son, you know, And I had never really experienced that family dynamics, you know. I didn't. And so I didn't, that didn't work out. You know, I didn't, that marriage did not work out. And I left. I lost that business, but because I had that trade, you know, getting work was never a problem. So I would, I was working all over Los Angeles. I was drinking a lot, and this guy who was the original guy who taught me this trade, one day he turned me on to Mini Benny. And just like when I saw that ocean, I knew this was something that was going to be in my life forever. And when I drank that beer, I knew that was going to be something that was going to be in my life forever. When I hit that speed, I knew this was something that was going to be in my life forever. And it was, and I'm a serial marrier, so I got married again not too long after that, to another good woman. I mean, she was a good woman. We moved to San Diego, you know, because my drinking was kind of causing problems in L.A. Well, I'll give you one little incident, and you tell me if you think it was causing problems. So I'm working in the San Fernando Valley for this guy, Joe, and I'm drinking every day. I'm riding a bus 2 hours to work and 2 hours home, so naturally I'm drinking on the way to work, you know, and... So Joe was going to buy a new car. So Joe came to work, and I'd been working for him for about 4 or 5 years by now, and he trusted me. So Joe told me he was going to buy a new car, and he had this envelope in his inside coat pocket with about, I don't know, $12,000-$15,000 in it. I never had $12,000 or $15,000. So he'd take his coat off every day, and he'd hang it up in the stock room. And you know what? From the time he showed me that coat, I couldn't think about nothing but that money. And, a few days went on, and I plotted this. I said, well, one day I'm going to get it. So what happened was one day a salesman came in, and they were talking, and I walked in there, and I took it and put it in my pocket, and I said, hey, Joe, you want a cup of coffee? And he said, yeah, and I went out the back door, got in my car, and went to the airport and back to San Francisco again. Now, I don't know if you would consider that a problem, but it... You know, and that pattern was that when things got tough, I took off. I left that wife, you know, came back, and all the time I was gone, all I did was drink. All I did was drink. And I wasn't drinking to have fun. I was drinking to make that shit go away. The way I was feeling was terrible, you know. So I come back I'm thinking that maybe L.A. is proving too much for me. So we decided we were going to move to... I drove down here one day. There was a job opportunity. I drove down here, got it, decided I was going to move down here, told my wife. I came down here first got a job and got a little place. And she came down. And, you know, this time it was going to be different. This time I wasn't going to take off. This time I wasn't going to stay out all night and drink. This time I wasn't going to lie about what I was doing, and I was certainly going to leave that speed alone. And everything went wonderful for about 3 months, you know. And then, you know, I was working in this shop, and there was a guy who had been there for a long time, and he drank, and it was acceptable, you know. And he always say, "Hey, Ronnie, you want a drink?" I said, "No, I don't want to do that." So one day, without any warning, he said, "You want a drink?" I said, "Well, yeah." And I had a drink, and the drink took me, and boom, I was gone like I had never, ever, ever been before. And shortly after that, one of the other guys that was working there turned me on to crank. And I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is really a part of my life. And I didn't know what it was, you know. It was something, it was better than anything I'd ever had. So I said, you know, after he turned me on to it that evening, I said, "I want to buy some." I said, so he took me over, and Bob the biker was there. So I walked in, and this guy introduced me to Bob, and I said, "I want to." He said, "Well, I understand you want to buy some." I said, "Yeah." He said, "How much you want?" I said, "All of it." I didn't know, you know, he laughed like that. You know, he laughed, and I was gone. I was, because I fell in love with that stuff. I didn't care about going home. I didn't care about nothing, you know. All I cared about was getting that and drinking. And I think one of the reasons I like that so much is because I didn't have to puke anymore. I could just fucking drink. I mean, I could drink like I never could drink before, and I loved it. And, you know, and all those things that happen to me when I drink, and they happen. You know, I'm not a very good husband when I'm drinking. I'm not a very good father when I'm drinking. I'm not a very good friend when I'm drinking, because I don't care about you at all. All I care about is getting more of what I'm getting and doing what I want to do. And, you know, back at this period of time, downtown wasn't the gas lamp district. Downtown was for people like me, you know, and I'd go downtown and I'd go in those China Doll and Singapore and Orient and drink. And that's all I did. You know, and it was getting to the place where my wife was just about fed up with me. And she had said on several occasions, "Ronnie, you got a problem with drinking." And I said, "I don't have a problem with drinking. You have a problem with drinking." And it got pretty bad. You know, we had an incident one night. I was at this, I bought another store here in San Diego, and she came down there one night, and I was in there getting loaded, and it got physical, and that was a pretty ugly scene, you know. And so, you know, she's done with me, and she's gonna divorce me, and she got the restraining order, and I said, "Look, maybe you're right. Maybe I do have a problem with alcohol." Now, I did not believe that one second, but I figured this might work. You know, maybe if I say that, she'd let me back in the big bed. And so what I did was I agreed to go to a treatment center. And I went to a 28-day program, Villa View. I think it's now it's Promises, but it had a 28-day program. And I went in there with absolutely no intentions to stop drinking. That was not my intention at all. I went in there to show her that I was trying to stop. So I went in there and I heard some things that made me think, wow, maybe this will work. So I stayed in there for 28 days, and I got out with every intention of trying to do the right thing. Even though it wasn't my reason for going in there, when I got out, I really wanted what these people said they had. And I got out, and I went to aftercare. And I went to a meeting now and then. I didn't go to regular meetings. They told me in this place to get a sponsor when I got out. They didn't tell me what a sponsor was. They said, be sure to get a sponsor. Well, there's probably some new people here, and people have been telling you, get a sponsor. A sponsor is a sober person who has taken the steps and is applying the program in their life that can help you go through the steps. And going through the steps, find a power that can help you stay sober. It's not somebody with a new car necessarily, or it's not a gal with a big ring. It's a sober person who has taken the steps and can take you through the steps. So anyway, I didn't know that. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and they said, if you want what we have, he had a big-ass car and a diamond ring. So that's what I wanted at that point. So, it didn't last. You know, I went to see him two or three times, and he didn't have any interest, or I didn't know what was going on. And anyway, I stayed sober for about 8 months, and then this guy came in my shop and said, hey, Ronnie, I got the kind, and I was gone. And I had no mental defense, you know. I didn't have a mental defense. I wasn't going to meetings. I didn't have a sponsor. I had not taken the steps. I did not have a power in my life that could relieve me from this disease. And so I was left on my own. And when he said, I got the kind, I said, well, give it up, you know. And I was gone, like I had never been gone before. And it was like I never stopped, and I was trying to convince my wife that I was still sober, and you know what? It didn't work, you know, and all the things that hadn't yet happened that I thought might happen, they happened, you know, and it was worse than it had ever been, and I had absolutely no control over it. If there was a big event that was going to happen, I could probably stay sober for a day or two to go through that, you know, and then I'd be back. But it had gotten to the place where I couldn't do that. I didn't have any control at all. And so, you know, that divorce that I didn't want to happen happened. And I remember my son at that time saying, I don't ever want to see you again. A lot of things have happened since then, you know. So, you know, I get divorced, and I loved that woman, and I loved that my son. I mean, I really did. But when she told me, she divorced me, it was like, as much as I hated to see that family go away, I was happy. Now I can do it the way I always wanted to do it. I don't have to lie about where I'm at. I don't have to sneak. I don't have to have damn tips and certs and shit. To hell with that stuff. I don't have to cover up my breath. And you know what? I was gone. And that went on. That was a living, screaming hell for the last 2 years. And I kind of thought that was the way it was going to be for me, you know. I didn't have anything going on, you know. And I didn't have any friends. I had one dude, and we get loaded together, and he'd steal my dope. So, and there was nobody else that I was hanging out with, you know. I was this bartender Bernadette, and I kind of played, you know. Let's get drunk and go to your house, you know. But you know what? I mean, it got to the place where if we weren't totally drunk, we didn't even want to see each other. So, and, you know, as much fun as that might sound like, it's really not, you know. And it's really not that much fun when you realize that you got nothing in your life but alcohol and substances. And that's where I was at. And I kind of accepted the fact that's the way my life was going to go. And this guy came into my shop to get some work done. I have a shoe shop, and he came in to get his shoe fixed. He had a bad leg. He had polio as a kid. So he came in and left his shoe, and as he was leaving, I guess that was a day that I looked especially bad, and he said, "Easy does it." Well, I had been in that treatment center, so I knew that that was an AA slogan, so I responded with something. I'll keep coming back. I don't know what I said, but I said whatever I said, he knew that I knew what he was talking about. So, you know, a few weeks or a month later, he came back to get some more work done, and he said, "You want to go to a meeting?" I said, "No, man, I'm busy. I had nothing going on in my life." I mean, when I say nothing, I mean I had nothing. My life consisted of this: arising in the morning, and by then all I could get down was I could drink. I was sleeping in the back of a shop with the big roaches and shit, and I had one of them little styrofoam coolers. Okay. I had it packed with ice, and I had a bottle of spearmint schnapps. And it had to be ice-cold spearmint schnapps in the morning. That's all I could get down. I'd get a couple of shots of that done, then I could drink other stuff. So I'd get that down. I'd do some other substances. I'd get going. I'd go down to the bar where this bartender worked, and I'd drink. And then at night, I'd go to the other places, and that's all I did. That's all I did. That's all I did. That's all I did. You know, in the divorce, you know, I had to be sober for 24 hours before I could see my son. And as much as I loved him, and as much as I wanted to see him, I couldn't stay sober for 25 minutes. And by then, it was, you know, I had no control over it. So anyway, this guy comes in and he says, "So, do you want to go to a meeting?" And this is like 2 or 3 weeks, 4 weeks in between. And I said, "Okay." And you know, when you get to the point where you know that you're hopeless, You kind of get softened up a little bit to where you're not so cool and you ain't got so many answers, and maybe when you see hope, you know what it looks like, you know. So he said, "You want to go to a meeting?" I said, "Okay." So he took me to Drunks Only when it was on Camino del Rio South, and I went there, and man, I was shot out. I was dirty. I had a straggly ass beard, and then people all looked like they had a going. Looked like you. Looked like normal citizens, you know. And I knew I didn't belong. And anyway, I went, and he took me again a little later, you know, I knew that you guys would getting sober, but I couldn't believe that it was going to work for me. So I went back to my store, and he came in one day, and he sat down, and he gave me the 10-minute version of his story. And it wasn't at all like mine, but he was sober, and he was trying to help me for no reason. And he was sober, and I knew that he wasn't bullshitting me, you know? When you hear the truth, even if you don't like it, you know the truth, you know. And the thing I knew about him, and I knew that I could identify, was I couldn't play no games with him. You know, I couldn't, half measures wasn't going to get it. Half measures, you know, half measures, that's like that teenage son of a preacher, you know. And the kid comes to his dad, and he said, "Hey, Dad, when can I drive the car?" And the dad says, "Well, when I see you reading the Bible more often, and your grades come up, and you get that long haircut." So, you know, a few months go by, and the kid comes back to his dad. He said, "Hey, Dad, how can we talk about me driving the car?" And he says, well, I've noticed your grades have certainly come up. And I've noticed you're reading the Bible, but you still got that long hair. He said, well, Jacob had long hair. And Moses had long hair. And Jesus had long hair. Dad said, yeah, and you noticed they walked everywhere they went. So, you know, those half measures don't always work out too well. So, this guy came in, and like I say, he gave me the 10-minute version of his story, and for the first time in a long time, I believe that maybe I didn't have to die in this crummy-ass little shop. And he came back the next day, and I said, Don, will you be my sponsor? He said, you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I had no idea what that meant, and I said, yes. He said, are you willing to take suggestions? I didn't know what that meant, and I said, yes. And he said, I'd be glad to be your sponsor. And you know, something happened right then, and what happened for me was I had this experience that no matter what he asked me to do, my only response was going to be okay. And trust me, I'm not an okay kind of guy. I'm not. That's not who I am. I'm just not that agreeable. But I said, I felt it. I felt it inside that no matter what he asked me to do, my only response was going to be okay. Now you know when we talk about how we share, it's like what it was like, what happened. But this is what happened. This is the part. You know, I can hear your story, and I might not understand the shit that happened to you in the beginning. And I might not even understand about what it's like now. But when I hear you tell me what happened, I can relate to that. And this is what happened. When this man offered me help, nobody else was offering me nothing. When he offered me help, and I saw that glimpse of hope, I grabbed it. And without any reservations, you know, and I knew he was going to ask me to do shit that I could not do, but I just said, I'll just say, okay. So the very first thing he asked me to do that day was he said, I want you to read step 3 in the 12 and 12 every day for 30 days, and if you miss a day, I want you to start over. And I, you know, by the time I got sober, I couldn't read. I could not read. I couldn't read hardly at all. And it's like, how am I going to do this? So I went down and I got one of them little pocket dictionaries, because step 3's got some big words in it. And you know what? I think the first few times I read it, it took me like 3 hours to read step 3 in the 12 and 12. And I read it for like, I don't know, 12 days, and I missed a day. It's like, oh, shit. What do I do now? You know, what do I do now? He don't know I missed it. I don't have to be honest with him. How's he ever going to know? But I told him, and I didn't know what he was going to do if I missed, you know. I thought maybe he was going to, I don't know. So the next day I saw him, I said, Don, I missed. He said, okay, start over. So, you know, I started over and I missed again. And I told him, he said, all right. And I read it 30 days without missing. And that was the first thing that I had done honestly in a long, long time. You know, he took me to the steps, you know, he didn't sugarcoat this program for me. He was a hard ass, and it's just what I needed, you know. One day, now, the thing is that this guy that 12-stepped me came out of nowhere, and his office was directly across the street from my shop, you know, directly across the street. And he would come over almost every day during the week and check on me. It's what he did. He checked on me. And so one day, you know, I went across the street to his office, and he was standing on his porch and was kind of smiling at me. And I walked across the street, and I walked up to him. He said, go back to the goddamn corner and cross with the light. I said, what kind of shit is this? a sponsor to love me? How's he going to treat me like this? And I was hot. I was hotter than fish grease. So you know what I did. I went back to the other quarter and crossed the street, cussing under my breath. And I came back and I walked up to him and I'm ready to say something to him. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "You know, Ronnie, the rules apply to you too." You know, it's been a long time since he told me that, but I remember that. You know, and I'm sober just a short time at this time. And Don and his sponsor and another guy that he sponsored, they had a commitment at a fire camp, Camp La Cima. And they drugged me with them. Now, I didn't even have clearance. I mean, I had warrants at this time, you know, but nobody checked. And they took me up there to Camp La Cima, and I'm sitting there, you know, and I don't know what's going on. And they're taking a meeting in, you know, and so the topic at this meeting was sponsorship. So they started talking about it, and my turn came to share, and I shared about how Don was my sponsor and how, you know, so there was this kid there named Matt. And Matt, when his turn came, he said, "Ronnie, will you be my sponsor?" Now, I'm sober. I know I wasn't sober 90 days, so I looked over at my sponsor because I knew he was going to say no. And I looked at Don, and Don went, "Yeah." So, you know, I said, "You willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" I said, "You willing to take suggestions?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "I'd be glad to." And you know, I would go up there and visit, and I took him a 24-hour-a-day book. And when he got out, I picked him up at where his release point was, and he came and spent the night with me a couple nights, and then he went home. He lived in Escondido with his parents. And, you know, okay. That always fucks me up. But as far as I know, you know, at 20 years, we both had 20 years about the same time. At 20 years, he was still sober. So I haven't talked to him since then, but there's one of the guys back there now that was at that fire camp, you know, and I see a couple others. And you know what, that just makes me know that Alcoholics Anonymous works. So, you know, my sponsor, he was taking me through the steps, and you know, it came time to do that inventory. You know, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable, and came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And it came time to do that inventory. And, you know, I had been out there on the road for a while, and I had done some stuff that I didn't want to talk about. And I was ashamed of, and I had some experiences that I was not too thrilled about talking about. But, you know, I believed that I had to do this to the best of my ability, or else I probably wasn't going to get a chance to stay here. So, you know, I wrote that inventory out. And in the Sunday, he told me to come up to his house, and I drove up there, and I was scared. I was. And so I went up there, you know, he was a hard ass, but this particular day he took me out to breakfast, and we went and sat in a church and listened to a little bit of a sermon, and then we went to his place, and we went out on his patio, and I read my inventory to him. And and I expected him to say, "We deal with the sick ones, but we did not expect you." And that wasn't at all what happened. You know, he said, we talked a little bit about some of his stuff. And we talked a little bit about some of the things that I had thought was me that it turned out that it wasn't. So, you know, we went into we went back in the house, and he said, "Why don't you take off your shoes and lay down on the couch?" And I said, "No, no, no." He said, "No, go ahead." And I would lay down and took a nap. And I got up, and that was a Sunday, and I came back in, and I came back, and I went to an Old Town speaker meeting when it was at the Machinist Union Hall. And I was, and after that, I went home, and I slept that night, and I got up the next day, and I was a card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous, Jack. And I wasn't afraid anymore. I wasn't afraid that I was going to drink, but I knew I couldn't drink. I knew I had to do some stuff. And one of the things that I had to do was I had to complete the steps. You know, taking that inventory is great, and doing the fifth step, you know, but the sixth and seventh steps, those are the ones that separates the boys from the men. And then comes time to make that list, Jack. And I made that list, and I had done some pretty bad things. And one of them was when I took that guy's $12,000, even though I brought it back and stuff. But I had to go and talk to him. And, you know, when I did that, he was amazed that I was sober. He said, "I didn't think you were going to live long enough to stay sober, Ronnie." So, you know, I have two other children by my first wife. I told you about my daughter, but I also have a son. And I've been able to reestablish the relationship that I have with my two children. You know, and we do good. And you know, for a long time, my youngest son and I were just we had a great relationship. And things change, you know. Last year, he was going to get married, and he had this big, elaborate wedding plan, and he wanted me to give him a lot of money. And I didn't have that kind of money to give to him. And as a result of that, he didn't invite me to his wedding. And he hasn't talked to me in almost a year. You know, and I love him dearly, and it breaks my heart. And a lot of nights I wake up hoping that it's going to change. And today, you know, he used to come to my shop on Saturday, and today was a tough day because I was hoping all day long that I'd see him pull up, but he didn't pull up. You know, but, you know, my sponsor, Don, used to say, because I would, you know, I had a lot of shit going on. You know, they were repossessing this, they were taking that. And I was always afraid. And he said, "So what's the worst thing that can happen if this happens?" I said, "Well, I'll repossess my truck." And he'd say, "Can you stay sober through that?" I say, "Yeah." He said, "So what's the deal?" So, you know, when this deal is going on with my kid, it hurts me. It hurts me a lot. But I think, you know what, I can stay sober through this. Because another thing he told me is nothing so bad that a drink or a drug won't make it worse. And you know what, Jack? When life gets tough, that's all I got to hold on to. Because the Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. It gave me a life. You know, I had a pretty decent life. I had a new car and a boat and a house and all that stuff. And alcohol, I surrendered it to alcohol. And, you know, I thought that I would never have those things again. But that's not true. I got a beautiful wife. I have all the trappings of success that I would, you know, that I thought were important, and they're nice to have, you know. But what I have is I have people in my life who would ride a bicycle up a fucking hill just to come because they're my friend, you know. A lot of people might have a lot of shit, but they might not have that. You know, and I got Mike and Mona and a lot of friends. You know, I that guy, that sponsor of mine, he passed away. You know, and but it took me just a few days before I got another sponsor. And the guy that is my sponsor now, Tom, was sponsored by who my sponsor was sponsored by. We have a long line of sponsorship, and we're... my home group is the Great Fact Group. Is it a traditional meeting? At my meeting, when you take a cake or a token, you wear a shirt and tie. And somebody outside asked me why I had on a tie, and I said because I want to show respect for the program that saved my life. And if I had gone somewhere to speak and I didn't have a shirt and tie on and my sponsor was there, ooh-wee. So, you know, I'm telling you what I believe. I believe this with every bit of my heart. And you know, sometimes people tell you stuff, they want you to believe it, but they don't really believe it, you know. It's like little Johnny. You know, little Johnny was a little kid, and he was riding his bicycle, his tricycle by the monastery, you know, and he's riding and he's going down this hill, and Father Murphy's sitting over there watching him, and he's riding, and boom, he runs into a tree, falls off the bicycle, skins up his knee, bends the wheel, gets up, kicks it, son of a bitch, you know. So Father Murphy comes around. Little Johnny, that's not the way we handle adversity. When we find ourselves in difficult situations, we ask God for help. Okay, Father. So he drags his broken bike home, and his mom patches up his little skinned knee, and Dad fixes the bicycle, and a few weeks later, I got you. So a few weeks later, little Johnny's out there with his bike again, and he's riding down this thing, and he, bang, runs into this tree again. Father Murphy sticks his head around and says, let's see how the little tyke handles it this time. So Johnny gets off, and his knee's scratched up, and he gets ready to kick the bike, and he says, God, please help me. And the bike wheel straightens out, and the knee straightens out. Father Murphy sticks his head around the corner and says, son of a bitch. So I'm grateful. I'm real. So the stuff that I've just told you, that's my story, and I believe it. It's happened to me, and I just say two more things so you don't have to raise that sign again. Number one is that if you want to get sober, Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous works a lot better for people who want to stop drinking. And the other thing I want to say is that if you take care of your brothers and your sisters, your Father will take care of you. Thank you.